I'm Christopher Lydon with the poet Peter Balakian and his new book, Ziggurat. He's picking up the baton in our poetry marathon. Whose Words These Are is our series with varieties of people committing poetry in these times. What are they saying? For whom? And why in one poetic form or another? This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Peter Balakian, welcome back to the Grow Your Poetry Bookshop in Harvard Square. You're best known for your memoir, Black Dog of Fate, as a writer about Armenian memory in the 1915 genocide in eastern Turkey, repressed memory among survivors, resurgent memory, and active outrage in the next generations born in exile. But your poetry, Peter, and certainly this new one, Ziggurat, widens the frame enormously, back to ancient times in Mesopotamia, up to 9/11 in New York, and the U.S. war in Iraq. How's to describe the scope of your new work?
Well, you know, I think my new work in some way continues to engage my imagination and the aftermath of catastrophe. Those broad zones continue to interest me. And I suppose they're sort of percolations along certain arcs in my work that come to new places. I hope that Ziggurat, you know, is a book that, you know, really does navigate some new territory. I continue to believe that the poem, the lyric poem, has the potential to offer us various rich, layered forms of memory, and that the poem can catch a filament or a fragment of a large event in its own, what I would call, speech, tongue, voice, syntax. And so the poem's ability to make music, a distinctive kind of music, out of often large and unwieldy and really hard to comprehend social or cultural events is something that I continue to pursue. Ziggurat is a book. It's my first book since my new and selected poems came out in 2001, and it's a book that really is set to a large degree in New York, in Manhattan, between the late 60s and about 2006. And I would say, I suppose, that the disaster of the World Trade Tower terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001 are a kind of haunting presence to the book, although the book isn't totally fixated on that moment, but reverberations and, I hope, subtle kind of vibrations of that event will, percolate through various poems.
Peter, take us back archaeologically, actually, to the ziggurat of the title and the buildings in Mesopotamia, the discovery, their meaning, their connection with the towers and with New York.
The ziggurat at Ur is a famous monument in the imagination of Western culture. It is the Aramaic word used by the Sumerians of southern Mesopotamia for great building, for what we today would call, you know, skyscraper.
In what we would call today Iraq, right?
Yes, today southern Mesopotamia, the ziggurat of Ur was excavated by the great British archaeologist Sir Leonard Woolley in the late 1920s and 1930s in what today is Iraq. In fact, he was there at the time that Iraq was becoming Iraq, and that interested me a great deal.
And one of his assistants married Agatha Christie.
That's right.
In the trivia department.
That's right. But she even gets into my long poem, which I'll come and talk about shortly. Agatha does.
Would you read us a fragment?
Sure. But let me say something about it before I read it.
Sure.
To kind of, you know, just explain a tad of what I was interested in. Ziggurat then becomes this trope for the monument of the great building. and one that connects us with, you know, a very ancient building, and that unspirals, if you will, or spirals, if you will, forward to the absence of the great building or buildings of the World Trade Towers in the latter part of the 20th century until the time of their destruction. So the long poem in my book, which is a 43-section poem called A Train Ziggurat Elegy, is interested in bringing together four strands of experience in a way that a sequential lyric long poem can do. And I'm interested in that form. I'm interested in the longer sequential lyric form. Obviously, in American poetry, that form goes back to Whitman's Song of Myself, Hart Crane's The Bridge, William Carlos Williams's Patterson, Pound's Cantos, and so forth. That's a form I've been pursuing, and I'm continuing to pursue it. So the 43-section poem engages four elements of, if you will, strands of experience. One is the persona in the poem is riding the A train down Manhattan, underground, of course. And in the A train, he's reading Sir Leonard Woolley's book about the excavation of the ziggurat at Ur in the late 1920s and early 1930s. As our persona is reading this, he's flashing back to a relationship and its ending of an earlier period in his life, which happened in the city. And he's also remembering his days when he was a mail runner, which is to say that I ran mail for a steamship company in Lower Manhattan. And I also came to watch the towers go up. I was there from the time the ground was broken to the day they opened. And I delivered mail to the North Tower days after the first 49 floors opened for business, even while the rest of the building was being constructed. So when the towers, this is a long way around to give you a little context for one other element of this poem. When the towers went down, the memory of them haunted me. And so that figures into the long poem. And there's one other strand in this poem, and that is that the protagonist discovers that his former student, an ABC anchorman covering the war in Iraq, has been nearly killed, badly injured, when an IED exploded in his face. And this brings just a filament of the Iraq War into my poem. And I mean a filament. It's a very personal engagement, and it somehow allowed the poem to open into close to the present. And so the poem plays off of shifting and colliding planes off of those experiences as they're colliding in the imagination of the A-train rider.
Do we have the four strands by now? Started with the narrator on the A-train.
I mean, we have the relationship breaking up. We have the towers being built and the mail runner watching them. And we have the Iraq War coming into the poem through the accident that happens to his student who's covering the war there.
Will you read some?
I think I'll start with section one. A Train Ziggurat Elegy, one. The tender head of the he-goat on the cover stares through the branches of a golden tree. And I'm just moving on a system of fuses while the fruit stands of Spanish Harlem fly above. And even now, remembering when we were here after Nixon waved goodbye and rose in the chopper, even now, seeing it through the double glass as Ur of the Chaldees, revised and updated, Sir Leonard Woolley's excavations at Ur, flares on the yellow cover in the momentary dark that wrapped our bodies all night like violent paint on the sheets, like the broken fire escape of our building. At 125th, the guy next to me reading Another Country, the white guy passed out in a suit and brown bag. The steel screeches the tracks, and the vaults light up. Section 4. I ran mail a whole summer down Greenwich and West. Before it even started, before we roamed Radio Row for 78s of Ellington and the Blanton Trio, before the yin-yang of real estate under the Kensett skies over the river, the wrecking balls took Radio Row down. Florists, groceries, record shops, restaurants, the whole mid-century slid into a pit, and the sun made gothic trees of the falling windows. Out of res ipsa loquitur, out of Port Authority and Chase, Rockefeller and Tobin, the Twin Towers rose from the garbage. 7. We met on a cold morning when the women were gathering dew. Start again. We met at a party in a loft on Green Street, in the no gravity of Barsamian's big canvases, post Magritte, you called it, a vagina and no head, breasts but no limbs. The red wine was Chilean. This was after Allende and Neruda. I watched your mouth in the dark reflection of the window, beyond which the light of the towers glared the black red. But still the need to ask, who wrapped the day in nectar? Who cracked the sun over the hedges? Who saw the light flare off the towers at dusk? What's loss, if not an open grave, where the heart's eaten by worms? 9. 1:30:06. John Hendricks and the cameraman, Al Deal, were standing up in the back hatch of an Iraqi armored vehicle, not a Humvee, something softer, taping the patrol. I was driving back to Hamilton in snow on Route 17, and the words came like distortion of sound from a dashboard. A combined operation with the Iraqi army and coalition forces, the voice said. Soft targets. IED jammers, wireless, embedded with the 4th Infantry. Your students always live in their seats, their faces smooth, teeth shining. John, 83, bristling, rugby energy in his chair. John was bleeding from the head. Am I alive? Don't tell Anne. Section 22. On the streets, I'll make a little notation here, Karachi is not the city in Pakistan, but rather the great family of Italian painters who did Baroque ceilings. On the street, I heard that the Indians were like cold-blooded dancers at high altitudes, Mohawks who had come down from Canada. I watched them glide with hot rivets and cold steel into the azure of near oblivion. Some days they disappeared in light, as if the narrow beams of air came undone. And they floated between steel and blue like lost angels of the Karachi. My head spiraled from the fumes of coffee and yellow bulls, red cranes, green trucks, pale blue drilling rigs, bull's liver, gooseneck, clamshell, orange peels, 192,000 tons of steel.
There are other poems here, Peter, about a relative who played trombone with Artie Shaw, about Emily Dickinson, about Andy Warhol. Do you want to give us a sample of those?
I appreciate the kind of you're focusing on artistic texts that become mediating emblems for me in trying to approach certain things. So let me start with the Warhol. I got very interested in Warhol's silk screens, and so I'll read one poem here called Warhol Electric Chair 63. The red spreads like Christmas wrapping, the green a field in a Caucasian rug. It's almost beautiful without the metal plates for the head, though the plug on the floor is visible. Before decorator colors and Hockney, Calvin Klein in the summery Hamptons, before there were switches to break the flow. My mother used to say, never touch a radio when you're in the bathtub. Never fly a kite near transmission lines. But still, it's furniture. Still, it's a typical American way to go. It's Sing Sing, the silhouette of Ethel Rosenberg. In the rheostatic air, the absent man heard, "She loves you." The British invasion and the flat line arrived at once. Outside, Negroes were eaten by dogs. Johnson was sworn in. Cuba turned red in the green sea. Should we do the trombone poem?
Yeah, please.
You want to do the trombone poem? Okay. That's fun for me. This is a poem that does take off on an ancestor, my mother's cousin, George Arusian, shortened his name to Arus, and was a really good trombonist. First for Artie Shaw, where he played first trombone, and then later for Tommy Dorsey, where he made the mistake of being in a band where Dorsey was the first trombonist, so he became the second trombonist. George made a lot of good music in the late 30s into the late 40s. He was from Detroit, okay? And his family, like all of my mother's family, were Armenian Genocide refugees and survivors. We lost track of him, but I discovered his music and have spent a lot of time with it in the last decades. Blue Room for George Arus, 1915-1960, ? 1. Bread lines were dissolving on 2nd Ave. Staten Island fog dulled the horns. The lamp-lit snow trailing into cold rain like confetti around FDR's motorcade. But it was seamless air, tongue and slide, breaking across the partials. More than Helen Forrest doing softly as a morning sunrise, or Shaw's manic trilling into the high morning where everything falls, the swirling lights, the acid rust of gravity that feeds the downtown cabs running on war bonds and lost radio waves. The poppy-colored walls screamed. The sweet arms and legs were light, then dark. You dropped down so many flights you thought you were floating back up into the dirigible clouds, into the rain coming in trefoils off the garden roof, into the blue room of the Hotel Pennsylvania. 2. You could ride the impulse beyond itself, part of the essence, age-old fire. The Armenian past was a smear of grease on the chassis line at the Ford plant in Detroit. Cooling into the big blow, the invisible coming off the Hudson, tonguing the singing thing the way you would do lover after the war, after the blonde woman left you for the whiskey-colored rooms in a western city. The A-train slammed the girders of Penn Station. The floor was smooth as any track. 3. You lived out on the edge of the Golden Horn. Not the Dardanelles, but the one you made, where the spray came off the broken edge, and the water lapped you all night long. You traveled across the dark, thin and keen and cutting, like the high D in The Thrill Is Gone, as the ghost notes drifted into the other life that rose as smoke so you could see it, like breathing ropes of myrrh that poured out of the chalice on the altar. All night it rose in coils to the ceiling of the blue room, into that last existence, that letting loose, the turn so sweet and smooth there was no need for embellishment. Who can stay up there all night long?
That's beautiful, Peter. A beautiful connection of the golden horn on the Bosporus, I suppose, to the blue room in the Pennsylvania Hotel.
Yeah, to the horn of the trombone, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's lovely. Peter Belakian, thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for this work. Thank you for a lifetime of work. Thank you for this conversation. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.